Let's get started. I'm Don Box. This is Chris Techter. We're going to spend about an hour talking about what it means to go write games on Windows 10. For context, I'm the platform and OS guy. I led the team that built the Xbox One OS, and now I work on graphics and media across all the operating systems. Chris, tell us what you do.
And I'm the game development guy. I work at Turn 10, where we make Forza. And I'm here to provide a view that's from a game developer on this whole process.
Yes, and you and I worked together on Xbox One, formed a great partnership.
We did.
As I recall, it was, you know, you said I'm a game, I said I'm a PC. We did the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. So, Chris, please get off the stage for a few minutes
okay.
So I can talk about the OS, and then I'll get off the stage and you can talk about what it means to a game developer. Fantastic. So let me tell you a little story. We're here to talk about Windows 10, but it is very useful to understand the historical context of how we got here. Because a lot of the decisions we make are not obvious until you understand why, where we were and what we did. So let's go back into the Wayback Machine to the beginning of this decade. 2011, right? Obama's in office, right? Economy's coming up, unemployment's going down, it's a lovely time. We had three products in market. We have three still, but we had three at the time. We had PCs, we had phones, and we had Xboxes. Most people in this room know about PCs. The code base started with Windows NT, and we keep evolving it and grinding on it, making it better and better and better, and we've been doing that. If I looked in the Wayback Machine and pulled out my Microsoft phone in 2011, I was running an operating system called Windows CE. Right, Windows CE started in 1996. Bill Clinton was in office. Turns out the economy was also pretty good, but for different reasons, right? But I had this CE code base, which was wildly different from Windows NT. In fact, it wasn't even derived from. It was developed independently, and we tried to make the APIs look similar, but we were not always successful. And if I look back in 2011, what console did I have in my home? I had an Xbox 360. Where did we get the OS for Xbox 360? From the original Xbox. And where do we get that? We forked Windows 2000, right? And we never looked back. So it was a fork and run project. So if you look at where we are in 2011, we had three wildly different code bases. And then we wanted to go do something. We wanted to take some of our code and make it run on all three. Right? We had some code, which was called the browser. And we wanted to put a browser on Windows Phone, and we wanted to put a browser on Xbox 360. I cannot tell you the horrific things we had to do to our code in the browser to go make it work on these wildly, wildly, wildly divergent operating systems. And we kind of hit the wall around 2011 and said, OK, we got to go fix this. And so what happened was, in 2012, we shipped the first wave of convergence, where we basically took Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8, both of which shipped in 2012, and we converged a bunch of the code. We got onto a common code base. We were able to have a browser that was much more sane, right? Apps had a lot easier time. And the code was much more similar. We basically derived Windows Phone 8 from the Windows code base, and we kind of had this nice docking effect. And then we cleaned up some of the gaps and did an even better job bringing it all together in Windows 8.1 and Windows Phone 8.1 in 2014. On Xbox, when we did Xbox One, we said, great, we cannot do what we did before. You have no idea what we had to do to go make that browser work. You had no idea what we had to go do to make Silverlight work on Xbox 360 to go enable all the media apps that you know and love and use on Xbox 360. So we started Xbox One saying, look, we want to get on this train. We want to have a world where when someone builds some technology, be it an app, be it a game, or be it just some core components we all want to go share, like middleware, right? We wanted to make it easier for everybody and have a common platform that we're built on. So we basically, on Xbox One, took the Windows 8 code base and said, let's go. And so what happens is when you boot your Xbox One and you see the shell, it's actually running on a derivative of the Windows 8 code base. Notice I said the word derivative, right? Because when we did these projects, we had different orgs, different schedules, different priorities. And so we were on the path of potentially seeing the same nightmare we were at in 2011. And so we said, look, for Windows 10, let's stop this and pull it all together. And so with Windows 10, we've actually pulled the three code bases together, brought the changes together so that we actually have a common operating system that we can go run these three products on. And it turns out we kind of had to do it. Because even if we were willing to pursue three different divergent code bases for these three products, we have this business requirement, which is people keep dreaming up new devices to go build, right? Things like animation, Go, thank you. All of these IoT devices, which is a big thing, we all know that, right? HoloLens, right, the thing that you put on your head. The Surface Hub, that thing you walk up to and touch. And God knows what other form factors that our hardware team or the hardware ecosystem will dream up. We knew we had to have a model that we could basically say, look, we're going to bet on one operating system code base, and we're going to bet on one platform for you and for us, right? And this is kind of one of these mutually beneficial things, right? It makes it easier for us to have like a common browser code base, a common Office code base, et cetera. But also makes it much easier for you because you get to think about one platform that you're targeting. And so with Windows 10, we have a common operating system that's based on a common core. We have a single app platform, and we have a single store, which is more about you than it is about us because it gives you a way to turn curly braces into dollars, right? Which is, I believe, how this industry runs. Cool. I would be remiss if I did not have this really flashy picture that the marketing guys pulled together with all these beautiful pictures of devices, right? All of these devices are running the same code, right? NTOS kernel, same thing on all of them, right? App activation, same on all of them, right? So we're basically moving to a world where every device we build is going to be built on a common code, starting with Windows 10. Now, let's talk about this common code, because it turns out we have a similar problem to you. There's a bunch of code that we need to be everywhere. So there's a base core of operating system components which we have elected deliberately to say, these will be everywhere. They will be the same code everywhere. And the model is we want to have a common platform that allows us to build an ecosystem of both devices at the bottom and apps on the top. But we add additional code to these which we ship on particular classes of devices. So for example, when Windows 10 is deployed on a PC, it has some stuff that is only there on the PC. The desktop shell that you know and love, the start menu, which I hear is making a comeback this year, right? The start menu only appears in the Windows 10 operating system for PCs. The availability to get to the broad hardware ecosystem of both white box PCs and arbitrary peripherals that you can plug in, all of that support is in Windows for desktop, Windows for PCs. And also, the commitment to supporting the existing long tail of Windows applications that have been developed since the 1990s, right? That's supported on Windows for PCs. If we look at when we put Windows on a phone, it's got some unique characteristics that are only available on phone. It's got the familiar mobile shell that's touch-centric with the tiles that you swipe, et cetera. It's got rich telephony support. It turns out we don't need telephony on an Xbox, last time I checked. Although maybe we'll change that someday. And of course, we have this inventory of hundreds of thousands of Windows Phone apps, which are in the Windows Phone Store, which we are committed to continue to make work on Windows Phone for 10. And then Windows on Xbox, the 10-foot shell experience, very, very different than the shells that run on the other. Shared gaming experiences, there's a lot of features around shared multiplayer that multiple users on a single device still supported on Xbox. And of course, we are going to continue to make the existing Xbox One games and apps that you've been buying and loving. All those continue to work. And then for each, on every device that we will be building, we'll go do stuff to make sure that we have an appropriate shell experience on that device and that we'll have device-specific scenario support. So if you build a device which is, I don't know, a glove, right? The Windows glove. I'm not announcing a product. I'm hypothesizing here. Right, the Windows glove will have unique characteristics that make it the best glove in the world. It will probably not have a start menu. It will probably not have File Explorer, and that's okay. But if it turns out the gloves and start menus make sense, then we'll go do it. Cool. Now, that previous slide is more kind of just showing you how we think about building the product. Right, we have a very, very rich and thick shared foundation that we put on every device. And then we add some specialized components to go make sure that the product actually makes sense. In terms of what matters to you is really, how do I go build an app? Don, how do I turn curly braces into dollars? right? Because that's ultimately what we're building. So for all of these device families, we have a single app platform. And that app platform has some interesting characteristics. One is it's designed in such a way that you can write an app that adapts to the form factor that you're deployed on, right? So we have the ability, even though you can write a single app, you can make the app better when you're on a large screen versus on a small screen. You actually make it great on both, right? And that's an innate characteristic of the platform. We also are exploitive of the input paradigms of the device, right? As we all know, controller is the only way to play a game. But we also support keyboard and mice. Sorry. Keyboards and mice are the best way to play a game, but we also support controllers, right? So touch, accelerometer, all of that stuff, we basically are upping the bar of what we can support in terms of natural user interface. And that's a core part of the platform. We have a common tool set. As you'll see when we go at build, the ability to go file new project, just say, here's the devices I want to support, all within a single Visual Studio experience and including a single Visual Studio solution. A common store and dev center. Right now, we have three different stores. We have a store for Xbox, we have a store for phone, and we have a store for PCs. We're pulling all that together so you have a single place to interact, both for ingestion and also for managing commerce. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about, which will probably be most of the rest of this talk, is a common SDK and a common set of APIs, right? So we've actually done a lot of work in this release to make sure that our APIs make sense across all of these devices. And if you've programmed against Windows Phone and Windows PC and or Xbox One, right, if you programmed against any two of those, you'll see a lot of the stuff is the same, but some of it's not. And so we've done a pass of really trying to get some of that stuff converged as well. So what is the app platform? What is an app platform? Well, so if I think about what we did in both Windows 8, Windows Phone 8, and in Xbox One, we tried to up-level the world from kind of base OS stuff that you learned in school, right? When you took an operating system class in university, where you learn about things like processes and threads, right? And on Windows, you also learn about things like DLLs and exes, right? PE executables. We tried to up-level the platform so that app was a first-class concept, right? And we started down that journey with Windows 8, Windows 8.1, Windows Phone, and with Xbox One, and we pulled it all together to have a single way to do this across all of these devices, which is what the Universal App Platform is about. First and foremost, the app platform defines an app model. We define that there is an app. It contains a set of binaries, a set of content, right? And it has identity. The system knows about it, right? If you look before Windows 8, the OS really only knew about processes and threads, right? With apps, we actually schedule and do resource allocation based on app identity, not just process identity. Processes are an implementation detail of what an application is. We have a common packaging model. That is, we have the ability to take all of the assets that it takes to go make your game run, binaries, content, text, and config files, and pull that all together into a single package, which we call an APEX package. We have a common deployment machinery that basically makes it possible for us to use the same code to take your application that you give us as an APEX package and then go deploy it to each of these very different form factor devices. And then, of course, once you've deployed it, it turns out you occasionally want to update it. We have that capability as well. One of the reasons we have an app platform is to create a place for app developers to make money. So we obviously have a deep investment in licensing as well as a common store. We have common tools, and then we have a common set of APIs. So when we talk about what the universal app platform is, existentially, right, this is what it is. Previous slide kind of told you what the benefits are, right? But when you think about what the app platform is, this is what it is. So we've got this term, which we're now using as of this week. It's called a Windows app. Guy walks into a bar, and he wants to get some code from some ISV, some game developer. He wants to put it on his machine. Turns out, if he's on a PC, there are two kinds of things he could go buy. Windows app and Windows desktop applications. The locations actually matters, right? So Windows apps are the apps that target the Windows Universal App Platform. So if you write a Windows app, you're writing an app that that can run on any of the form factors that we've talked about. It will be able to run on an Xbox One. It will be able to run on a phone. It will be able to run on a HoloLens, right? So all of the devices that we talked about in that big Pantheon slide, all of those support Windows apps. So if you're thinking about trying to go broad and catch all of these devices and get on that train, you will be writing Windows apps. In contrast, Windows desktop applications run on PCs. And there's a lot of PCs. We love PCs. We love Windows desktop applications. But so that you understand the difference, Windows desktop applications will not run on phones. They will not run on Xboxes. They will not run on HoloLens, blah, 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 blah. Right? Going back to that picture of all the fancy devices, the top row is where desktop applications, the entire slide, is where Windows apps run. Make sense? So Windows apps are what we're going to talk about mainly here, although we'll talk about Windows desktop apps and some of the differences as we go along. But let's talk a few things about Windows apps. They have strong identity and are known to the system, right? They're described declaratively using an AppX manifest, right? When you author a Windows app, there's a Gymundo XML file that you edit in Visual Studio or in your text editor of choice. I like Emacs. To basically declare, here are the capabilities and requirements my app has, so that when we ingest that thing, and then when we subsequently deploy it and load it, we know some of the requirements of your app. Things like resource requirements, access to special capabilities on the device. Apps are packaged and deployed in these things called AppX packages. An AppX package is produced when you build using our tools with the SDK or with Visual Studio. And an AppX package is effectively a signed zip. Right? It is, in fact, a zip file. You can open it up using your zip decoder of choice. And we put digital signatures on it to prevent tampering. We also do a lot of other crypto machinery throughout the pipeline. Windows apps have isolated per-user storage that's managed by the system. So your app has its own place to scribble state that the other apps can't see. And you have a place to scribble it for all users and a place to scribble it for each individual user. So basically, on a machine that has n users who have ever signed into it, you'll have n plus one places to scribble. One for each user, and then the one that's shared across all of them. And finally, Windows apps participate in application resource management. That is, their resources are managed, and we're aware of them as part of the way the user interacts with the machine. And they interact with this thing called process lifecycle management, PLM. So those are the characteristics of a Windows app. In contrast, a Windows desktop application has no strong identity. It shows up through MSI in uninstalled programs, but that's about it. Beyond that, once it's deployed, the only remnant we know that it's an application is you've got an MSI footprint. There's no declarative declaration. It's like, you know, main, go, right? What more do you want? Okay, great, we have one declaration. Are you subsystem console or subsystem Windows, right? There's our declaration, there's our metadata. How do you package it? However you want, right? There's a variety of ways of doing it. Isolation of storage, you know, live the dream, there's the file system, what more could you ever want? Cool, so it's very different. Let's talk about APIs. But before I talk about APIs, I'm gonna talk about ABIs. I have spent a lot of time with game developers over the last 4 years now. And this topic comes up a lot. And so I really want to just make sure everybody is ground, we baseline as to kind of what some of the physics are here. How many people in the room, show of hands, know what an ABI is? Awesome. What is it? Application binary interface, exactly. And it turns out that's the more interesting conversation I want to start with, and then we'll talk about APIs. So every operating system, every platform has an ABI. And basically what it is the binary contract that says, here's the calling conventions, the way you make calls across binaries that are independently deployable. Right? That's what an ABI is for. On Windows, we have three, count them, three ABIs that are very related. In fact, they build upon one another, but it's important that we just clarify and ground them out right now. Win32 is the original ABI. It is the ABI we introduced with Windows NT 3.1 back in 1993. And it's effectively just some conventions around structure packing and register usage for calls. order of pushing things on the stack, things like that. The canonical definition of it in our C compiler is this declaration called std call. So if you mark a function std call and you stay within certain bounds with relative to structure definitions, live the dream, you conform to the Win32 ABI. Great. And all of the Win32 APIs conform to the Win32 ABI. Right? And we're not going to talk about what those APIs are yet, just so you understand mechanically what it is. Sometime a long time ago, we invented this thing called COM. And COM was an evolution of the Win32 ABI, which basically said, look, we would like to have objects in addition to just structs and function pointers. And so we took a little bit of enhancement on the Win32 ABI, and we defined this thing called iUnknown, and from that begat the COM ABI. And we defined a lot of interfaces using COM. WinRT is just a derivative of COM. It's a set of additional conventions on top of COM, and it's another ABI. The differences are, instead of deriving from iUnknown, you also derive from iInspectable. And the set of parameter types you use is a subset of the ones you can use for COM. And by the way, the ones you can use for COM is a subset of the ones you can use for Win32. So those are the three ABIs. When you hear Chris or I or anyone on the planet use the term WinRT, it means that third bullet. Right? That's what it is. The WinRT ABI is yet another ABI that we use. The reason WinRT as an ABI actually has been very valuable for us is it allows us to define an API in WinRT once and then consume it from a bunch of languages. It turns out consuming Win32 APIs from a variety of languages is kind of onerous. Consuming COM is also onerous, right? We designed WinRT to be able to be suitable to the languages that were, you know, in popular use when we started. And it's holding up rather well for supporting new languages. So those are the three ABIs. And you'll see all both Windows apps and Windows desktop apps, both of them have access to all three kinds of APIs. Right? So JRandom Windows desktop app can call WinRT APIs. Right? There are WinRT APIs we are defining to be consumed by either kind of app. Conversely, a Windows app has a certain number of Win32 APIs it can call, right? So just because you are writing a Windows app does not mean you can't call Win32. Just because you're writing a desktop app doesn't mean you can't call WinRT. But you cannot uniformly call all of them from everywhere. It turns out the API surface area that we expose to Windows apps is different. It is distinct from the set that we expose to Windows desktop apps. Why is it different, Don? A couple of reasons. One reason is, in general, when we expose something to a Windows app, right, for that subset, for that section of API, we need to make it work on all devices in a reasonable way and have the ability to degrade gracefully if we can't. And also, we have issues with app isolation, right? Part of the whole notion of the universal app platform is we isolate apps from one another, and certain Win32 APIs violate that. Conversely, there are WinRT APIs that aren't available to Windows desktop apps simply because the runtime constraints of those apps is different. In general, new technology, if we're going to go invent a new foo, the glove, right? I'm not announcing the product. That does not exist. Actually, it may exist, and I've just not been told about it. The Windows glove, right? If we define new APIs for the Windows glove, in all likelihood, they will be WinRT APIs. Right, because by defining in WinRT, we're able to reach all languages with a single API, single doc set. It has lots of upside. If you are a C++ programmer, by the way, show of hands, how many people program primarily in C or C++? How many people program primarily in Objective-C? We've got one iOS developer. He's going to come over. I can feel it already. You are now my target audience, friend. How many people program primarily in Java? C#? Oh, interesting. JavaScript? Fantastic. I would say about half the room programs in C++, which is good because we wrote the talk for a C++ audience. Fantastic. There's a variety of ways to program against WinRT ABIs from C++, and Chris will talk more about them later on in the talk. I talked about the overlap. Actually, I just noticed a bug in the slide this morning. That green bar should really move over to the right to subsume all those WinRT APIs. So pardon my last minute edit. Basically, there's a bunch of WinRT APIs that are available to both Windows apps and to desktop apps. There's a bunch of Win32 APIs that are available to both Windows apps and Windows desktop apps. And there's a bunch of unique apps, unique Win32 APIs that you can only get to from desktop. There's a bunch of unique WinRT APIs you can only get to from Windows apps, XAML being a big one of them, right? So XAML right now is only available in Windows apps. So guess what? It's a huge, dense surface area. So the proportion here is a little bit misleading. Great. Now, one last slide, then I'll turn it over to Chris. Remember that slide I showed earlier that showed kind of the common core, and then we have code for Windows PCs, code for phones, code for Xboxes. It turns out we needed the ability to build an operating system and have components get deployed only on certain form factors. Guess what? If we need it, in all likelihood, you need it as well. Right? So you have the ability, based on the way we built the platform, to write a single binary, single set of assets, and deploy them everywhere. Right? And for many classes of applications and probably some classes of games, that's a fine way to go. Right? Single set of assets, single code base, live the dream, deploy it. In general, with the WinRT APIs, we make them degrade gracefully so that if the capabilities of, that you're looking for, like Bluetooth or like an accelerometer, isn't on the, your Xbox, it's OK. You can call the APIs, and you enumerate, and you get back expected results. We have the ability also to dynamically light up APIs so you can actually tell at build time whether or not something's going to be present. Now, you will inevitably, especially for games, want to put assets that are appropriate to a form factor, right? We know that, we embrace it, we love it. It's an intrinsic part of the app model. So we do have in the project and packaging system the ability for you to write device-targeted assets, both in terms of binaries and in terms of art, and only have that available on certain form factors. So that's a capability, but again, the goal is it should be your choice, not ours, right? So in general, we give you the tools, we trust you to figure out, you know, I don't really want a 4K bitmap that I need on my Xbox One to show up on my phone. So this is what we built. I just told you. Now, to tell you what it really means to you, the one and only Chris Techter. Give it up for Chris.
Hey, everyone. So Microsoft Studios has been more than happy to be engaged as early as possible in the Windows 10 process, because what we can do is push the platform out to truly represent what a game is going to need from it. And importantly, with the new Universal App Platform, all game developers are going to be able to deliver their games to the entire Windows ecosystem with a single code base, including Xbox. And there's a clear path to unlock the features and performance on each of those devices. What I want to do is kind of break down what the promise is. What are you going to get from the OS? I'm going to spend a good amount of time on what you get from the app model, and then a bit of time on what it really looks like to tailor for each device. So to start off with, on the OS, Windows 10 for games means performance. Whether you're looking at the improvements in Direct3D 12, the drastic reductions they made in per-call overhead, or say the improvements they made internally to their multi-threading, so you can efficiently generate rendering commands and rendering resources on background threads while you're submitting all those commands and resources from your foreground thread. This really gives you a huge improvement in your CPU overhead. And with the driver reduction and D3D reduction, you're also now almost entirely game on your CPU instead of all the resubmission threads that you used to see. Another point is that with Windows 10, there's been improvements in the memory model. So now with system memory, there's a reduction in paging. And this reduction in paging means, for most of us who are used to PC games, a reduction in hitching. And also, alongside that, in system memory, there's been a reduction in overall size. So now there's more space for you to run your game in. And another point about memory is on the video memory side. So now you can allocate and reserve video memory entirely for your game. And the OS will protect that reservation. And it'll actually cycle through the other background processes that are running and make sure that they can live and make forward progress within that remainder. But what that means is that you're not performing any texture swapping because you have a protected space and you can count on it to be there. And then finally, and this was missing from some of the earlier Windows 8 app models, within Windows 10, particularly in the OS, there's now a way for you to correctly identify the work that you want, the threads that you want to run per core, and they will remain on that core. And importantly, you can partition away the other OS work that's happening on your behalf to the other cores. They won't interrupt it. They won't cause these hitches on your mainframe loops. This has been a great improvement. And I'll talk about this a bit later, but some of the background work that happens on in the rest of the OS has also been quieted down. So in the end, from the OS, you're getting more memory and more CPU performance for your game. But let's talk about the app model itself. Well, Windows apps, as Don said, are written to the Windows Universal App Platform. We say universal a lot today. A universal app binary can target all devices. But let's kind of break down what that universal binary means. We all know that that doesn't mean that you're running one executable across all the different devices that exist, because they have different CPUs. So what you're going to end up with are, in your binary package, you have an executable that's actually been built for that particular CPU architecture that that device has. Yeah, if they share it, they'll run the same executable, but if you have a device that has a different CPU architecture, you're actually getting a compiled executable that's targeting the best performance it can get for that CPU. And maybe more importantly, what universal really means is universal source, so that you're only porting once to the platform in order to target all the devices. And what that means is you can be agile with your business decisions. You can take your character rendering in your game and actually use it in a mobile experience, and you're using the same rendering code and the same content. And this is just going to let you do more with what you have. So the next part of the app model, as you saw on Don's slide that had all the big boxes on it, is the packaging. And with a Windows app, in that package, you have that explicit manifest that we talked about. And what this does is identify the application to the user so they can see names and they can see tiles and pick it in interfaces and things like that. But importantly, it identifies the application to the OS. It lets the OS know about what features it needs and what the device requirements are so that that app will only run on a particular device if you want it to. And with that packaging, what it means is that the OS is now managing the install process for you. You can build a manifest, and you can actually validate it and test it locally, and the OS is responsible for going and figuring out how to install it on people's machines and how to debug that install process. You're no longer spending time doing that. You're putting your effort into defining that manifest. And importantly, since Windows is managing the installation, they can also manage the updates for you. Now, another point about having this package is that the OS now knows what makes up the application. So we can identify each of the executables, if you have multiple ones for your application, inside that package, and it can say, hey, that's not the right one. It's been modified, so it can flag it and potentially prevent it from executing. So it's kind of a security measure as well. And there are limits that it's going to provide. So when you're in a contained environment that the application has, you're not going to be able to access things like the registry or the environment or even parts of the file system. But importantly, that means other applications aren't doing that behind your back. You've probably all experienced bugs where some other application has been installed and uninstalled, or the user's messed around with what the environment is in the OS, and now you're no longer stable or you're no longer performing the way that you were when you first wrote your application. And speaking of resource management, I touched on it a bit, but with the application model, you're actually contained and you have a well-defined space that knows what CPU and memory limits you have. And importantly, the OS can manage that for all of these contained applications. And that includes, with Windows 10, this is an addition, that includes the background OS services. So now there's an entire ecosystem of processes that are running on the OS, and all of these are being managed to provide the best performance for the foreground executing game, right? So you're getting the most performance you can. And with that resource management, and this was actually introduced back in Windows 8, there's the idea of an application lifecycle. And the important part about that for us is that with this lifecycle, while it includes a bunch of events that are more like user interface focused, For games, it includes some of the most important events, like, have I been suspended? Am I about to be terminated? Am I foreground or not? And by signaling these to the game, what you get is a chance to save off data. So a user won't lose their progress if they've been swapped away and then they accidentally terminate the game or they run out of power. This is going to be great for everyone because, in the end, you want to be able to provide that continuous play experience. And it's important that most of those resource management improvements, they show up at these transition points in the process lifecycle. So those are the key points where you're potentially going to lose your video memory reservation if you've been suspended and put in the background, so that another game can get theirs. And then I touched on not being able to access different components like the registry or the file system. Well, it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, get at files, and it doesn't mean that you can't use your favorite Win32 file APIs. What it does mean is that the areas of the file system are actually contained and related to the application. And importantly, Don touched on this, that they're tied to that, that application's identity, and so you can have storage that's tied to the application and tied to the user. And that means that it can also, the OS can synchronize that across devices. So I can play your game at work on my PC, and then I can go home and continue right where I left off on my Xbox. So now, what does it look like? You know, I'm a universal app, and I want to target all of these devices, including the Xbox. What do I really get to do in order to target specific features? In the end, the universal nature of these apps doesn't rule out being able to customize for each device. You might want to add touch for mobile and tablet and things like that, or controllers, as Don pointed out. But in the end, you're going to want to add some specific functionality, and the reason I brought up Xbox is that Xbox has some specific performance hardware in it that you might want to get access to. And in the end, what you have are API contracts. And what these let you do is query in the runtime, detect whether or not a feature is available, and then you can actually target that feature, engage the code that you have that maybe implements your touch UI. But importantly, it's your choice. You can still choose to have code that only runs for a particular form factor, and you can choose to deliver that to a particular device by declaring it in the manifest. So in the end, if you want to, you can ship a single binary, but if you don't, you can add all of them. And this is important because in an engine, if an engine provider has given you an entire code base, they might want to support all of the different input paradigms, and they can. But now let's kind of go over some of the scenarios. So there's some big questions that came up as we were going through the porting process, and we wanted to touch on them and make sure that some of the biggest questions we asked in front of you and hopefully give you the answers for. So to begin with, what did it all take? You know, we've been going through an implementation and porting process internally. We've been partnering closely with companies to port major engines to Windows 10, both Unity and Unreal. And as part of that, we've been porting the middleware that those engines sit on top of for physics and audio and such. And then on top of all that, we've got major titles that have been porting to this platform. And so what that means is that we've covered the broadest set of APIs that we can see for games. And that means that we're already proving out whether or not those APIs are there and whether or not they're working the way that a game's going to want them. And on top of that, it means we're already pushing large content games through the entire tool chain, through the submission process, and we can see what it looks like to have a 50-plus gigabyte game in the store. And this is important because in the past, the tools weren't ready for that. Now, when it comes down to it, though, when we were porting, the work really bucketed up into two main areas. There were build modifications that we had to make, and there were API modifications. On the build side, it's really introducing this manifest and introducing the packaging process into how you construct your builds. And a lot of games, if you're already a Windows phone, a Windows app, a Windows Store app, or say an Xbox game, you already are packaging. With the universal platform, you're now just packaging to a common format. With a lot of desktop games, you might be using a Visual Studio project solution-based build system. That's also going to be a pretty easy translation process because we already have control over that kind of build arrangement. But for some games, and it's some of the ones that have the bigger, they might be cross-platform, you might have a more complicated build system set up. But in a lot of those cases, what we found, at least with our engines, is that you already also have the hooks that you need. There was a reason you went to a more complex build system, and that was so that you could hook each platform's way that they wanted to build things. And that means that you can also add in the hooks that we have so that you can declare the manifest and then package up your application. So the other bucket of work was really around API conversion. And as Don's slide showed, there isn't a direct overlap of everything you could get on desktop in the Windows app space. But what there is there's a tool that will identify. So once you've built and packaged, it will call through and say, OK, you're calling this function, and that's out of bounds. And it'll suggest a replacement. So not only are you getting a port process that is letting you target the universal platform, but you're getting one that's helping you get there, basically. And in the cases where there were APIs missing, since we've been able to push these large titles through, we've actually been able to identify APIs that, hey, this is actually going to be important to games and champion for that internally. So hopefully you guys have everything that you're going to need by the time you get your hands on it. Now, speaking of APIs, one of the big questions that always comes up is, are there any complex decisions that have to be made, you know, while I'm making that conversion? And the single biggest one that a lot of people talk about, at least for the C++ developers, is the difference in these two main programming models. On the one hand, you've got the Windows runtime library, the WRL. And with this, you can write a whole bunch of COM code yourself to interact with these Windows features. But when you do that, you'll be able to handle error codes in kind of a traditional H result manner. The alternative is calling with C++ CX. And what this does is add some syntactic sugar to C++, and then the compiler will generate all that COM code for you. Now, the trade-off here is that you're going to be handling error codes with exceptions, because in wrapping or in generating all that COM code, it's also going to wrap all the error codes and exceptions and hand them back that way. So it's really a choice that you have to make. Do you want to handle errors as exceptions and not write all that COM code? Or do you want to have direct control over how you handle errors, and you're going to write the COM code yourself? And I want to point out that both of these have an inherent asynchronous programming model. This was added for a lot of the modern Windows functionality so that more traditional kind of user interface apps could move OS work off of their user interface threads to kind of improve interactivity. But in a lot of cases, what we found with game engines was that games were already used to moving this work off of their main threads. We didn't want any OS calls because we wanted the smoothest possible experience. So in a lot of cases, what it really is doing is adding an extra asynchronous hop, but a lot of the handling is already in place for you to be able to request something and then be able to wait for the result. And in both cases, I want to point out that you should wrap your chosen path. This is just a typical thing that you might do where you're going to wrap OS functionality in a layer to isolate it from the rest of the application code. It might be typical in cross-platform development where you have different consoles you're supporting. But importantly, it means that since you have this isolation layer, that you can contain where you've had to take on that choice. So if you chose to go the C++ CX path and handle exceptions, you really only have to do it in that isolation layer, and you can translate back out to the error codes on the way out. So another question that came up is, you know, what does it look like to be a store developer if I'm used to delivering as a traditional desktop application developer? Well, in that case, you might not have had to deal with things like developer licenses and submission processes. For phone developers or Xbox developers, you've probably already done this. But I wanted to point out what the specific definitions of these are for a Windows app, if you are new to the space. A Windows developer license, this isn't really the big legal, I had my guys talk to your guys type of license that you arrange. It's more like a certificate. And it lets us tie the developer's identity to any application that they submit. And that means that we can track who you are, but also importantly, nobody else can publish on your behalf and kind of steal your credit. And really, this is a very automated process. There's a link on MSDN that you can get to that'll explain several ways that you can get it. But if you've been running any of the modern versions of Visual Studio, like 2013, then you already have one of these developer licenses because you needed to get it just to start up. It's part of the process. Now, another aspect that's probably new for desktop developers is the certification process. When you submit your application to be published in the store, you're going to go through certification. Part of it is automated testing. It's to detect viruses and malware. But another part is the WAC, the Windows Application Certification Kit. And this is that tool I was talking about earlier, that when they run it, they'll be able to say, hey, you've called something out of bounds. But importantly, you can run it because it's delivered as part of the SDK, and you can run it locally and do all of those replacements before you ever submit. So you can make sure that you're clean when it's time to submit. Now, another step that happens with submission is a manual process, and that's to really validate content. And it's not content, decisions that people are making. It's really just to make sure that you aren't delivering content that's out of range for your rating. So you're not delivering adult content to an E-rated title. And then finally, a point I want to make about certification is that for each device, there might be specific certification requirements. And a great example here is the Xbox. When your game is running on the Xbox Dash, you're going to have to follow certain certification requirements about how your game appears in the Dash and what types of behaviors it has to follow as games are being cycled through. So another question that came up, speaking of Xbox, is what technically is an Xbox if I've never looked at one? I'm a phone developer, I'm a traditional desktop developer, and I haven't really paid attention, you know, to what really is in the internals of the Xbox. Well, there's a lot of performance capabilities that exist in the Xbox. And importantly, it uses a highly optimized fixed virtual machine layout. And this virtual machine layout has two partitions. One of these is shared, so multiple games can be running simultaneously, and they're sharing within that partition. But importantly, when you're shared, it doesn't mean that they're equally sharing the resources on the box. The game that's in the foreground is going to get the majority of the resources that are available to that partition. But it doesn't mean it gets everything. If you really want the full performance, then you're going to run in the exclusive partition. This exclusive partition is there for a single game. It includes a deeply optimized Windows that commands the majority of the hardware on the box while that game is running. And this is the same game OS that exists today, that you're playing titles on today on an Xbox One. And it's going to have some slight modifications just at the surface level so that it can align with the universal platform. But at the core, it's still the same game OS that is delivering the performance that we want in games today. And on this side, on this exclusive side, is where you'll get access to specific hardware that has performance capabilities that you might need for your game to run at full rates. For further details on this, though, I want to hand off to Chris Charla's talk later today. On ID at Xbox. So the next one, and kind of the last big one, is what does it really look like if I really want to target the fullest install base? In the first couple of years, the D3D12 hardware isn't going to be 100% of the install base, and so you might need to target both 11 and 12. But I want to point out that the true difference here isn't in the content itself in order to support it. It's really in the complexity you're willing to take on in the rendering path. You aren't making and shipping twice as much content just so you can target 11 and 12. When you look at the size of it, the textures, the models, the constants that you have to define your materials, they're all the same formats for 11 and 12, and they're all both under your control, so you're making the same choices you have before. And because those choices are the same, your artists aren't having to make new choices. They aren't making new choices about what texture compression formats to make. They can use the same ones on 11 and 12. It is possible that you might unlock enough performance that you're adding features to your engine, but that's a benefit in the end. It's not something that's required in order to support the two. Really, what it comes down to is the complexity in your code. And that's really focused on your highest frequency interaction phases, so where you're submitting rendering commands, say, for your main render stages. For things like post-processing or lighting, you're not really having to make as many changes because you can use the same algorithms. You're using the same compute shaders for the most part. You're using the same pixel shaders. The render target formats are the same. The buffer formats that your compute shaders touch are all the same. So in the end, you don't have to make new decisions about algorithms you might want to implement for 12 versus 11. You can use the same ones. It's really down to how you handle the resources, the resource lifetimes, and how you've been able to shave off all of that call overhead, and that's the benefit of what 12 is giving you. So that's a set of the questions that we thought came up. I'm sure we haven't touched on everything that you guys want to know about, but if you do have further ones, we'd love to hear your feedback. In the end, Windows 10 is going to give you the performance you want for your game. And being a Windows app developer is going to let you deliver your game to more than 1.5 billion devices through the Windows Store, including the Xbox. And using the Universal App Platform is going to let you use the same code everywhere. Whether you're just putting a game on an Xbox in your house to show your friends, or you're delivering the next big thing to gamers everywhere, you're growing and utilizing the same code for all devices. That's it for today, and we're open for questions.
There's no slides left. There's our first questioner.
It's good to be quick. So neither this talk nor Phil's mentioned anything at all about Kinect, which seems like a subtle but clear message you're deprecating Kinect. So what do developers, you know, plan for Kinect for the future, if there is one?
Oh, look, we're continuing to invest in Kinect and in other, you know, sensor technology. It's a rich environment that we're not walking away from.
So we can count on it for another year?
You can count on Kinect for another year.
Okay.
At least another year. I do not want to be interpreted as at most. At least. Thank you.
Until you phase it out for the Microsoft glove. Sorry, I might be slightly out of date because I haven't actually published anything on Xbox One yet, but having extensive experience with the Xbox 360, the TCRs and by proxy the FTCs were gospel law in the studio. With taking things from the Xbox environment and putting them onto the PC, are we expecting to see similar levels of support? There won't be, obviously, because we don't have direct control over the environment, so it'll be lots a broader ecosystem, the exact same requirements, but are we expecting to see a push towards more directive of, as to what you should do in terms of standardized testing and ways of approaching the Windows 10 environment?
Right. Really, the submission requirements have gone down from the 360 era, and they're even more, I don't want to say lax, but there's a smaller amount of them when you come onto the desktop. We're trying to get to the point where there's a common set, but as I said, there's always going to be specific ones for each device. And that'll probably be true for PC, but I would imagine that would be the smallest subset because it has, you know, the most open form of interaction with the applications.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Okay. Thank you.
Hello. We have a particularly unique set of requirements for, we do wagering applications, and so, for example, we have a racetrack in Mexico, and we need to make sure that nobody is remoting into that device from the United States, we're not being RDP'd or in a VM or anything like that. Since you're essentially sandboxing like iOS and Android, am I going to be able to have that level of security somehow if I do the new model?
So, and you mean specifically on the PC?
Yeah.
Or
well,
PC, on
all
of
devices.
Universal?
Yeah.
You're not talking about RDP specifically, are you?
No, but you can remote control a phone. You can. There's a ton of stuff you can do to cheat the system, and the American government doesn't like us to let people in the United States gamble in the Bahamas or Mexico. So.
I don't know of any new constructs in the OS that we're adding specifically that would change the way it works today. And I think it's largely orthogonal to the app plat.
So I could still get like a list of all running processes on the device?
Windows app cannot enumerate all processes on the device.
Okay, that's what I was sort of getting at.
But I think that's also true Windows 8.
Okay.
Great. For store apps, that is.
I'm wondering what work you've done on the documentation side for which APIs are not available in certain ABIs and so on. So we've gone through the process of going from Win32 to WinRT, and we're a cross-platform developer, so there's been a few pain points where we actually just don't know where to go. And the documentation has kind of got pretty scattered over time. So what work has been done to make that more readable nowadays with Windows 10?
Great question.
Yes.
I have no idea exactly what's happening. I don't know. It's going to get better.
Okay, good.
I had a couple of questions. There was a sort of quick transition where you talked about the
client playing a game at work and then coming home and continuing it. So are you talking about cloud-based storage? Are you like is that accessible through? Maybe I was in late. Maybe I missed that part of the talk. But is that just on by default in Windows apps? What's the what happens when clients don't have internet connections and things like that? Is that all just sort of taken care of cleanly?
Well, if you didn't connect to the internet, you couldn't transfer your save home. So.
But transfers just happen automatically. Do they?
Yes, when you are connected, that storage is tied to that user, and it would just translate for them or transfer for them.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so there's no distinction for developers between files that we store per user that are local to that machine and local or that are shared.
Yes, you can discriminate.
Oh, you can. Okay.
Yeah. You basically have local and roaming.
Right. Right. Good. The other question was around Unity. You sort of touched on Unity really quickly. That's the platform that we're using. Is it possible to, is the process for that it will spit out a manifest file that we can then customize in order to achieve per endpoint specifications or customizations in the way that you were describing? Or is there deeper integration within Unity, within Unity to support that sort of per device customization?
I don't have particular details on how they're exposing that in their interface, but traditionally the way they've built, it's all been built into the interface. So you'd have control to say, I want to target these different platforms and what kind of capabilities you wanted. That's my experience with 4, so I don't know what it looks like in 5.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So with these new things, as a game developer, it's clearly much easier to target a large sort of range of devices. But if I did something that was very heavy on, for example, graphics, is there any way I can control that customers will not get a bad experience by just going to the store, buying my game on, I don't know, Surface 2 or something, and it would not really work for them just because it doesn't have the performance? I'm not talking about API level support, but, you know, performance sort of tiering.
Right, so similar to being able to restrict to a device or restrict to devices that have a feature, you're asking, can you restrict to the level of performance a particular feature can expose?
Something like that, exactly, right? Yeah.
There's a lot of discussion around that, but I don't think we have a definitive story about it. It's definitely an experience that people want to be able to limit to, so watch this space.
And we've certainly done the down payment on that for Windows Phone, right? Like, you can actually say, I need at least, you know, this amount of memory in order to be able to run. I have no idea how detailed we'll get in terms of resource capabilities in the store. And we're generally not talking about the store until build. So.
And he was just pointing out that there's still the traditional feature level detection that you can do, right? And that's how you can expose, I want to run on that. But I think you're more talking about performance of a particular.
I was just thinking of GPU performance because we see the right range of stuff all the way from a gamer PC to a Raspberry Pi, whatever you had on the slide, right?
Yeah.
And like, it's not just going to be text resolution that's going to solve it there.
No.
The glove will have no GPU, I believe.
It's going to have an amazing
GPU. We're going to build that product now. Yeah. I actually now I'm going to, you know, I got my 20% project.
If someone's got a great game on Windows Store and they haven't published the Xbox One before, I understand technically that it'll be quite easy to do that. From a curation standpoint, the XBLA SDK, is it, I couldn't quite get if which aspects, is it all of that will be made available via the ID at Xbox program on top of the developer registration that one has for Windows Store right now?
So there's a great technical open space, but if you want details like that, you should really go to the ID at Xbox talk later today or contact Chris Charla.
Okay.
Yeah.
Something tells me this is the last question.
Something that has a 987 on it.
So I was wondering about, since Windows 10 is going to be across multiple devices, are you guys going to have shared users somehow so that they can log in, like an iPad, a phone, the Xbox, and everyone, so that, you know, game statuses, they could always load their game statuses from each device and all that fun stuff. Is there going to be something like the Game Center or like Google Play Services that's for the Xbox?
I mean, Xbox Live we're making even more investments in this release to make Xbox Live span devices.
Okay, so.
Right, and if you install like Windows 10 today, go join the Windows Insider program, right, you'll get the Xbox app, which is, you know, there's a lot of your gamer stats, even if you never touched a PC before.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.